Imagine, like, trying to play a high-stakes game of triage chess across 158 square miles. Oh, and it's 90-degree heat, and you've got a 35-mile-per-hour wind actively trying to, burn your town down.
Yeah, that sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Right. But that wasn't a hypothetical drill for Grant County Fire District 7. That was just their 4th of July weekend.
Exactly. It's intense.
So today we are looking at the June and July 2026 Fire Chiefs Report from GCFD7. And really, our mission for this exploration into the source material is to take what looks like a totally routine administrative document and extract the actual adrenaline-fueled reality of modern firefighting and community management. So, okay, let's unpack this, because what this department faced is just staggering.
It really is. I mean, this document provides a masterclass in how a local agency balances extreme crisis management with, well, just day-to-day survival.
Yeah, the basic operations.
Right. To really understand the strain they were under, you have to look at their dispatch volume.
Yeah.
So in the entire month of June, they had 43 calls for service.
Which is a lot for a rural district.
It is. But then, during the 4th of July peak operational window, they saw a massive spike. We're talking 28 calls packed into a single grueling 15.5-hour operational period.
Wow. That's what, almost a month's worth of emergencies in half a day?
Essentially, yeah. And this included 20 distinct wildland-urban interface incidents, or WUI incidents.
And for those listening, WUI incidents are basically where fires break out exactly where, nature and neighborhoods collide, the highest risk zones.
Precisely. And the weather conditions were just a perfect storm for disaster. You have ambient temperatures over 90 degrees, relative humidity below 15%.
I'm dry.
Yeah, completely dry. Plus those sustained north-northwest winds you mentioned.
I mean, managing 20 distinct fires across a 158 square mile footprint in those conditions, it's like a real world game of whack-a-mole, but the moles are explosive wildfires and the wind is cheating.
That's a very apt way to put it.
So how does a department physically cover that much ground when the resources are stretched to the absolute limit?
Well, what's fascinating here is the strategic synthesis of their response. It wasn't just, throwing trucks blindly at a problem.
Right. They had a system.
They did. The chief leveraged their on-duty intern cohort, and they recalled their volunteer personnel to maximum capacity. And then they triggered an all-county, all-call to bring in regional mutual aid.
And amazingly, it worked. I mean, they achieved a 100% structure defense success rate. They even saved the town's water maintenance facility.
Which is critical infrastructure.
Huge. And zero civilian casualties, zero personnel injuries. They did have to issue brief level one evacuations, which is basically a get ready to leave warning just until that mutual aid arrived.
Yeah, they had to buy time. And they also made the really hard call to enforce the Soap Lake Municipal fireworks ban. They even canceled the public display just to stop any new ignitions.
Which I'm sure wasn't popular, but obviously necessary,
Yeah.
especially with that 150-acre third alarm wildfire they were fighting along Highway 17 north of Soap Lake.
Oh, that was a massive test of their coordination. Because it was so wind-driven, they had to execute localized drafting operations, meaning they were pulling water from natural sources because they were operating in non-hydrant zones.
Drafting is so labor-intensive, right?
Incredibly. But they managed it alongside mutual aid from the Grand Coulee Fire Department.
And somehow, amid all this chaos, they pulled off this massive PR win. They had Nance Beston from the Columbia Basin Herald doing a Facebook live stream ride-along, so the public is getting these, real-time updates while they work.
It's brilliant transparency.
Yeah.
But, surviving a 15-hour barrage like that, it completely depletes a department's resources.
I bet.
You can't just cross your fingers and hope the next fire holds off. You have to rebuild and upgrade the arsenal immediately.
But how does a rural department actually afford to do that? I mean, they don't have endless city
They
budgets.
rely heavily on data and just pure ingenuity. The chief is actually using this extreme weekend to document what he calls critical resource friction points.
Ah, so turning the chaos into hard data.
Exactly. He takes that data straight to the board to justify future peak demand surge staffing and interagency radio interoperability enhancements.
So they can communicate better next time.
Right. And as for the physical equipment, I mean, they function almost like a custom vehicle manufacturer at this point.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because you'd think they just open a catalog and say, "We'll take that fire truck." But no. The report mentions they're getting reflective decals for a new tender, sure, but they also added an off-road forklift for rugged terrain.
Yeah, because standard trucks just don't survive in the brush. During wildland fires, dropping pallets of water and heavy gear into roadless terrain is a logistical nightmare. That forklift acts as their ultimate supply line enabler.
And they're acquiring a 6x6 vehicle through the federal FEPP program, which is the military surplus program. And they are literally building a tactical tender from scratch using an already prepared tank and motor.
It's pure resourcefulness.
But I have to push back a little here, though. The report goes into all this detail about meticulously tracking FEMA grants and applying for a 5-year FEMA Safer grant for recruitment and retention. How does filling out paperwork for a 5-year grant actually translate into boots on the ground during a wildfire?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, grants and administrative compliance create this self-sustaining ecosystem of readiness.
Okay, how so?
Let's look at Unit 7-120 from the report.
Oh, yeah.
They specifically note that they equipped it to Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, specifications.
Which are pretty strict, right?
Very strict safety and communication standards. But by meeting those specs, that unit suddenly becomes deployable for state mobilizations.
Oh, I see. So essentially the bureaucracy is functioning as their primary tactical supply line. Like, if they fail the paperwork, they fail on the fire line.
Exactly. It opens doors.
Yeah.
And because they passed those DNR inspections, they were able to participate in their first state wildfire mobilization, responding to the Guard RD fire and the Human fire.
Which is great real-world training.
Right. Invaluable training for the crews. Plus, it generates a supplementary revenue stream from the state that cycles right back into the department's budget.
That's incredibly smart. But obviously, all this gear is completely useless without the people operating it. Which brings us to their human infrastructure. So what does this all mean?
It means the personnel management is just as complex as the fire management.
It really is. I mean, reading this, they feel like a hybrid of a local business, a medical clinic, and a Navy ship. They are literally doing officer development using a book called It's Your Ship by Captain Michael Abershoff,
which is a classic text on naval leadership and command climate.
Yeah. And they're managing standard staff transitions, too. Captain Babak left to work at a data center, and their new training officer, Captain Friesen, is already coordinating with GCFD-13. But what blew my mind was the medical side.
The contract specifics.
Yes. They have a new medical program director starting July 1st, Dr. Hodges. And the contract explicitly puts a price tag on emergency care. It's $22 per call for basic life support and $44 per call for advanced life support. That transparency is just wild to see on paper.
But that cost structure makes perfect sense operationally.
Really? Why double the cost?
Well, basic life support, or BLS, is your standard stabilization. Advanced life support, ALS, involves paramedics, advanced airway management, and cardiac drugs. The sheer cost of readiness, the training, the gear, the liability for ALS is inherently double.
That makes sense when you put it like that.
But, you know, the human element we're talking about extends far beyond just these operational and medical metrics.
Oh, for sure. They are deeply embedded in the town's social fabric. I mean, every Thursday morning, they host Tea with Chief at the Cloudview Cafe.
Which is a great touch.
Yeah, and they marched in the July 4th parade, and they even ran a highly organized 20-team 3-on-3 basketball tournament. Shout out to Captain Boldman and CW for running that, by the way.
This raises an important question, though. Why does a fire department, already stretched so thin, spend operational energy organizing a basketball tournament or drinking coffee at a cafe?
Right, sounds like PR fluff.
Exactly. But these aren't just community service projects or PR stunts. They're essential trust-building exercises.
How does that trust translate back to the fire line, though? Like, does knowing the chief help put out a fire?
It absolutely does. When you look at their looking ahead section in the report, they are preparing for an upcoming EMS levy.
Oh, which is a tax measure the community has to vote on to fund those medical services we just talked about.
Right. And they also need community compliance for severity staffing during red flag warnings, which signal extreme fire danger. They even need the public support for basic capital projects like repainting and redoing the bathrooms at Station 2.
Ah, I see.
A community is much, much more likely to vote for a tax levy or heed a critical evacuation warning if they personally know and trust the officers giving the orders. You build that trust at the Cloudview Cafe in peacetime, not when the sirens are blaring.
That is such a profound point. For you listening, we started this by looking at a standard municipal document. But what we found is this incredibly complex operational web. It's extreme weather combat. It's clever financial maneuvering through federal surplus and state mobilizations. And it's highly calculated community bonding.
It really recontextualizes the whole job. And I'll leave you with this thought to mull over. If a local fire district today must function as an emergency medical clinic, a custom vehicle manufacturer, a statewide mobilized military-style unit, a grant writing agency, and a community event planner.
Which is an insane list of jobs.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Is our traditional historical definition of a fire department completely outdated for the vast operational realities we actually demand of them today?
Wow. That is definitely something to think about. The next time you see a municipal administrative report, just remember, behind all those dry bullet points and budgetary notes, there might just be a high-stakes game of triage chess against a 35-mile-per-hour windstorm.